It is 9 a.m. in the West Coast. It is 12 noon in the East Coast, and it is 7 p.m. in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. Today is April 13, 2016, and this is Orly Benny Davis with The Impossible Truth. Today on BBS Radio, we are going to pay attention to some news that we just, you know, heard. But we didn't really pay attention recently to what's going on in Libya because everything was so chaotic in Syria, and the Russian playing a part, the Iranian mixing up with Hezbollah. Everybody were putting their eyes up north, and nobody was paying attention to what's going on in, you know, in the southern of that, in Libya, Egypt, and maybe the Saudis did. But President Obama did make a difference when he announced his concern. Let's listen to that.
President Obama, speaking in an interview with The Atlantic magazine published on Thursday, had a bit to say on post-Gaddafi Libya while discussing foreign policy. He went into detail as to why Libya has become a failed state, and he admitted that some of the blame lies on a lack of support from our European and Gulf allies. That, combined with long-standing tribal divisions within Libya, all that is the cause for the failure of the mission intended to stabilize the country and bring in a democratically elected government. So I'm not going to go ahead and say that he's just simply putting the blame on all those things, diverting, you know, all the blame from him, because he has said in the past that he could have and should have, well, the U.S. could have and should have done more in making sure that they stayed there longer. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case, and he's basically alluding to the fact that there are many, many factors that go into why Libya has become a failed state. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more things that go into it. It's a very complicated situation. Now, I have a quote from that interview, which he basically lays things out very clearly. Check this out. "When I go back and I ask myself what went wrong, there's room for criticism because I had more faith in the Europeans, given Libya's proximity, being invested in the follow-up. The U.S. actually executed this plan as well as I could have expected. We got a U.N. mandate. We built a coalition. It cost us $1 billion, which, when it comes to the military operations, is very cheap. We averted large-scale civilian casualties. We prevented what almost surely would have been a prolonged and bloody civil conflict. And despite all that, Libya is a mess." So there he cites the UN mandate, a coalition that we made. He basically said that we only spent $1 billion doing it, which isn't a lot if you compare it to other missions, as well as citing the fact that we averted large-scale civilian casualties. Now, that second part, when he's talking about we definitely dodged the bullet because we could see a huge civil war in Libya, which isn't necessarily happening. It's almost as bad, but it's not quite there. I think what he's saying, he's kind of talking about speculation at that point. So I don't really use that as the best excuse for what he's saying. But, I mean, what do you make of it, Kanika? I mean, he seems to be not putting the blame on other people, but just letting everyone know that this is a very complicated situation. And it's not just the U.S. that has sole responsibility here. It's the Europeans and our Gulf allies as well.
No, he's not putting the blame on everybody, but I am kind of a little surprised by President Obama's statements. I mean, I sure have never really heard of him saying, pretty much unveiling a curtain to his feelings and his thoughts about this. I mean, he even quoted in the interview that there's been a trend about other countries kind of relying on the U.S. to take these actions, yet they kind of sit back and don't really do much. He was implying that. He was also implying that the U.S., it wasn't really their core interest to also go into Libya. So that makes me think, like, is President Obama, what is he trying to say? What is he trying to imply here? Especially, it's almost the end of his term. He's trying to kind of clean up the messes in a way as well. So to me, I mean, I see it in two different ways. It's like he definitely isn't putting the blame on the countries. At the same time, he's saying, listen, U.S. can't do this alone. Mm-hmm. U.S. certainly cannot fight ISIS, too, in the future. And if they're going to be kept left off and disregarded by the other countries, it's going to be a problem.
That's for sure. You know, I was a little bit surprised to see him come out and talk about this in the first place, to be honest with you. But you brought up a good point. To be honest, like I feel like what happened in Libya kind of served as a very cautionary tale for the Obama administration when dealing with future endeavors. For example, if you look at the way that Obama handled Syria, for example, and Iraq, and the whole ISIS issue within those two countries, I think we were a little bit more reserved And we played like a backseat role a little bit more because of the disasters that went on in Libya. And as everyone knows watching this here in this country especially, I mean, Obama got so much crap for Libya, and especially for Republicans. That was their main thing to stick on Obama, right? And they didn't really let that go. And then especially the 2012 September attacks in Benghazi on the U.S. Diplomatic grounds at the embassy in Benghazi that killed four Americans, including our diplomat there, our main diplomat, our ambassador. So that as well, you know, especially for Hillary Clinton, who was the Secretary of State at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's be honest, she's still getting crap about that in the Democratic race at the debates. They keep bringing that up all the time, and she doesn't like to talk about that. But it's extremely sad that that is kind of politicized now and kind of used against them. But that's just the way the politics work in this country, I guess, when we're, you know, so split down the middle. So here we see Obama coming out, basically saying, letting everyone know, speaking out for the first time in detail about, you know, his regrets when it comes to Libya and who the blame should really be put on, apparently saying it's not all on the U.S. and specifically the Obama administration.
All right. And we are back. It's Orly Benny Davis with Impossible Truth. We are talking about the situation in Libya. Now, why did it come up at this stage? You know, I spoke today with a great gentleman, Dr. David Gerbi, one of an incredible activist, Italian-Libyan, that works around the clock to safeguard the Libyan situation. And it was explaining to me, you know, since 1969 to 2011, we had Gaddafi in power. Gaddafi was marching over all the tribes. He was in charge. He took control of everybody. But since 2011, we had an intermediate government that was led by Jalil. And he was supposed to be in power, you know, for quite some time until they stabilized the area. And sure enough, they made him out. They got him out of power, if I understand correctly. Now, what happened? There was in place a Tripoli-based legitimate government that was supposed to be leading the country until October 2015. That Tripoli base felt insecure, and he moved. He moved to Sala, I guess, in order for it to survive. However, there was the illegitimate government that took control over in 2014 and made it clear that it's not happy with the Tripoli. So what the United Nations actually did, they took some of the Tripoli base and some of the legitimate government leaders and constituted a new government to lead. Now, we were supposed to hear about a vote to get the new prime minister elected, but the vote did not happen. But this time, there is an April 17. There isn't gonna be a vote. It means next in 4 days, you're gonna have a vote in Libya about the legitimacy of the new regime. The problem that we have, that, you know, the Americans are all in check with that, but we have the Russians that are really upset with the general that is running the army in Benghazi, and that's where the turbulence is problematic. Because if you consider Libya, that has three regions, the east, the west, and the south, you can understand that the division of power is divided. And you get the minority, the tribes that are in the south that actually are responsible. No, the minority are in the north, I understood. But in the south, there is a resource of a lot of oil, a lot of natural blessings that God gave Libya that are in the south. And they're connected a little to Mali. Remember, we had not long ago a situation where the Mali got rebelled, so they confined with Libya. The French wants to include that section with all the oil, you know, the base there, and to bring it with the Mali's government. That's where the resistance comes up. So we need to understand that it's a part of Libya. It cannot be taken. And the new government that is going to be elected this, you know, 17th of April, supposed to be the one that in charge, and they're going to nominate the new parliament. But we have a situation where the rebels need the voice. They need a representation, because if you have the, you know, a lot of representation that in check, they're good. But I think that David Jerby is the one voice that we need to hear more of it. And maybe next session we're going to talk about it can play a role incredibly in this situation. Now, I got more stuff. Let's listen to the next segment on Libya.
As many expected, Libya's fragile peace is falling apart. Tripoli's unrecognized Prime Minister Khalifa Houil urged his ministers not to stand down to the unity government. Some believe there's a split within the Tripoli authority.
Most of the public institutions in Tripoli announced they are ready to work under the Presidential Council of the National Unity Government, but Khalifa El Gweil backtracked from his earlier stance in Tripoli. His main aim is to ensure that he still has presence and influence within the new equation in Libya.
Earlier, Libya's UN-backed unity government had moved to cement control over the country's finances and institutions. One of its main missions is to unite Libya's political powers under one leadership to fight off ISIL. But it's not an easy mission.
The peace efforts hit a wall because of the contradicting agendas of the different points of view on how to solve the crisis in Libya. I believe the main problem is the absence of nationalism within the political spectrum in Libya. The politicians here are even more divided now on local and international issues.
According to UN envoy Martin Kobler, there will be another round of talks to convince the political powers to come together. Most analysts accuse Libya's rival militias of being influenced by foreign powers. And as long as they continue to do so, the situation in Libya will never improve. Yas Hakim for CCTV, Cairo.
The UN-backed unity government's surprise entry into Libya's capital this week has been described as a shaky debut, and its uncertain reception has pushed the peace process back into limbo. Here at the United Nations in New York, questions persist among Security Council members over how to proceed after an earlier decision by the militia-led Tripoli government to cede power was reversed by its leader. Now, the UN held a closed-door session this week in which Security Council members heard from UN Special Envoy for Libya, Martin Kobler, on the prospects for a peaceful handover. According to diplomats, Kobler said the situation on the ground remains fragile, and he underscored again the need for the UN-backed Libyan cabinet to, and I quote, go from the conference room to practical work. But there has been resistance from hardliners in Libya's rival governments, as we know, both governments in Tripoli and Tobruk. Now, the key concern among the international community is the growing threat from ISIL in Libya. Russia said during this Security Council closed-door session that despite some progress, the situation is dire and a central authority is needed. France said the unity government has a historic opportunity now to reverse the chaos that has allowed the extremist threat to thrive in Libya. And the UK said the council will be working closely with the unity government to make sure it has the support it needs to prevent this government from toppling before it's even really started. Now, several countries are mulling operations to fight ISIL, but they will need a request or approval from the legitimate government of Libya to intervene militarily. The UN has made that a prerequisite that Libyan approval, a prerequisite for expanded intervention, as have Western nations, including the U.S., France, Britain and Italy, although France has just ruled out launching airstrikes and sending ground troops, and Italy wants a Security Council resolution before deployment. Li Lingtan, CCTV, New York.
The Italian government has recalled its ambassador to Egypt for consultations in protest over the death of student Giulio Regeni in Cairo. The decision came after Rome's investigators met with Egyptian officials for 2 days in order to be briefed about the probe into the killing. 28-year-old Giulio Regeni disappeared in Cairo on January 25th while he was reportedly on his way to meet a friend. His body was discovered on February 3rd in a ditch on the outskirts of the capital, showing signs of torture. The case has strained the relationship between...
All right, that was rolling already. For some reason, it seems like Italy is taking, a very strong position right now in the region. There is a change of cards. Remember, we are all reorganizing the mess that was created in the Middle East, and everybody is trying to make its part. I know that the foreign minister of Italy is in Libya today. That's what I heard. And it's important because it means that there is dialogue. There is some kind of a lot of interest, a lot of Italian interest in Libya, and we should use it because they have economical power. They can make an engine of a country go, because they know how, and they work very well with the West. And of course, we know that there is the Prime Minister of Italy visit to Iran, so it means that it stabilized the region. Now, you guys have to understand, when there is a chaos, the important thing is to work with people who can make everything work. It means that Italy, if it's the player of the time, let it work. Let it do its job in Libya. Let it give some representation on the board. And the United Nations, this is Cobbler, the third guy that already was assigned to Libya. And seems that Martin Cobbler does know what he's doing, and it's gonna get started. So if we're going to have a good vote on April 17, God willing, we're going to start, in the motion to move forward to stabilize Libya. And of course, the government that they're going to put in place need to answer all the challenges. But if Italy is a player, if Britain is a player, and the United Nations is doing the job with all the coalition that America organized, I think we're set to a good, better time, let's hope, for Libya. So having said that, I know that you heard about the student that got killed in Egypt. That was not known. So sorry for that, but things like that are going to have to be investigated. Anyway, let's keep on going. I'm going to put some music now, if I may, so we can transit to the next section. All right? All right, and we are back. I hope you're having a good Wednesday. We started today. It's going to be a busy weekend. Everybody is going crazy here in Israel because it's before Passover. And the things that people have to do to, it's seasonal cleanup and, of course, shopping. And you need to replace everything and matzah. It's amazing work, and it's an incredible time, and spring is as lovely as ever, in Middle East, and I hope that peace and happiness will follow for for everybody in the region. And once we talk about the region, we talked about Libya. Now think about Libya. It's an angled EDF, a nice neighbor, Egypt, that started, the spring, the Arab Spring. And it starts settling down. And we have a great news coming from Egypt. They met with the Saudi kings, and let's listen to that.
The Saudi and Egyptian leaders went into a second round of talks on Friday morning. Topping the agenda was the fight on terror and the chaos in the region.
I am totally confident that the joint coordination between Egypt and Saudi Arabia will be the real focal point to solve the several crises in the region, such as what we are witnessing in the Palestine case, Yemen, Libya, and Syria, as well as other conflicts.
The long-awaited permanent Arab army was thoroughly discussed during the talks.
I'm optimistic that we can together retain the concept of a united national front to stand and face terrorism and extremism that dent stability and are a danger for all of humanity.
Meanwhile, the Saudi king announced the construction of a bridge to connect both countries.
I agreed with my brother, the Egyptian president, to build a bridge to connect the two brotherly nations that are located in the center of the world. It is a historic step to connect the Asian and African continents by road. This will have great benefits as it will raise bilateral trade between the continents to unprecedented levels.
Sixteen deals were signed by the two governments. Most of them were MOUs to cooperate in various fields, such as nuclear power for peaceful purposes, electricity, energy, housing, agriculture, and developing Sinai.
The many agreements signed today reflect a new phase to work together and ensure a better future for the upcoming generations of the two countries.
The Egyptian president had granted the Saudi king with the Nile Medal, Egypt's highest medal of honor. Experts say coordination on all political issues and the high number of agreements signed on Friday send a message that both countries are cementing their relationship to deal with the challenges facing the region. Yasser Hakim for CCTV, Cairo.
All right, and we are back. So as you hear, the Saudis are taking a really incredible step to unite two continents, Asia and Africa. Think about a bridge, and they are planning to invest like $1 billion on some building there. I guess that the big daddy of the region decided to take charge. The Saudis are playing. I know that there is some news that are just surfacing about the involvement of 9/11 and the Saudis preaching or helping terrorism. But right now, their action seems to be to fight terrorism, to bring peace and stability. So we want to bless any movement that defines terrorism and build bridges. So think about the Saudis, you got the Egyptian, and if Libya is going to settle, and Jordan, which is another a part of the Hashemite kingdom that is ancestor of the Saudis, you got the whole region starting to turn to be on the peaceful side, if we can hope for. It's going to be amazing if they're going to accomplish it. Now, I heard the news today, something I'm telling you, it's only news. I'm not sure that there is, the talk between the Israeli and the Turks. The Turks are having a hard time coming to terms to the fact that Gaza is still under siege. Well, it's not under siege. It's being protected. Israel is protecting its border from enemies, combat, and Gaza is close by to be a threat, so it has to be controlled. And the Turks don't want it, but for some reason they want the Egyptian you know, prime minister to recognize the Turks. I don't understand what's going on there in the detail, but in generally speaking, Turks is playing all parties and it's paying the price, obviously. But those Saudis are on the move to create some kind of anchor in the region to stabilize everything. And if they work well, it's going to be set. Now, the question was, you know, if you connect the bridge between Africa and Asia and all the vessels that need to be transported, this was an accord with Israel on the peace accord in 1978. So the question was, are the Saudis going to set the rules anew, or are they going to keep the same peaceful accord that Egypt has with Israel? So it was mentioned that they're going to keep on having the same accords, but without any direct talk or negotiation. She's okay, you know, everybody has to keep his part of the game. But we need to remember that there are rules that we cannot break. And the rules of Holy City of Jerusalem is a rule that the Saudis want Israel to break. You see, if you think about 2002, the Saudis offer a peace accord with Israel. They say, you go back to pre-1967 borders, and all the Arab nations, 2002 then, remember that this was before the Arab Spring, all the Arab nations will start signing peace accord with Israel. But what they were asking actually, it's like, give up God, because Jerusalem, the holy city of on Temple Mount, is the holy city of the whole world. It's a holy temple was standing. You know, we're talking biblical, of course. We are transferring it to what the Saudis actually are asking. If somebody asked you, said, okay, I'm going to be in peace with you, but I'm going to take your heart or soul, that's actually the soul, well, you ain't going to stay, right? You're not going to survive it. Even though you give your hand in peace, but actually you're killing my identity on the other. So I want to push back the Saudis offer with saying, not without God. God of Israel needs to be. And that's where peaceful coexistence in the region will come to play, when we all are in the same place, whoever we are, and respecting one God. That's the ultimate test of the universal truth. And it's something that we all have a hard time accepting one another, accepting one's belief. But the truth of the matter, what we really care about, you know, you have to respect each other for being human. That's all. All the rest, you know, it's like, what do you dress for dinner? It doesn't really matter. You do whatever you care for, as long as you keep respecting one another. And that's the conflict that still has to settle. The fact that the Saudis are saying, yes, we want peace, we fight terrorism, right? But you're killing people that are not Jews or not the Muslim, Jews and Christian, because they are infidels. If you're thinking that way, it's not going to settle anything. We need to reassess. Yes, we want peace. Yes, we want to make business with everybody. We want to be the light upon nation. It means that we bring technology, we bring businesses, we'll connect. We, of course, help. Today, I heard that in Jordan, there is a base for the refugees and for, you know, a panic room, they call a trauma room, to save people, that was established many years ago. I didn't know about this when I was calling to help the refugees, and it means that, you know, more and more stories are surfacing about how many Israelis group are out there to help the refugees that are technically enemy, but it doesn't matter. That's where we are. We are people of the world. We are going to be with each other, and we're going to live here. That's it. The whole deal is just accepting it. Let's listen to some more music.
Chiudo gli occhi e penso a lei, il profumo dolce della pelle sua, è una voce dentro che mi sta portando dove nasce il sole. Sole sono le parole, ma se vanno scritte tutto può cambiare, senza più timore te lo voglio urlare, questo grande amore.
All right, and those are the Volo. Grande amore, the big love. You know, nothing can beat the Italian romanticism. You know, you can try, you can copy it, but you better learn Italian to understand what they're talking about, because the love, the passion, and really classic. You can't compare it. Of course, you know, you love in many different languages, and whatever you like is the most important thing, as long as you are happy. Remember that we have to be kind to one another. And of course, sometimes we overboard, you know, we forget. Sometimes we make incredible gestures and immense difference in people's life. And sometimes we need to redeem ourselves. Now, there was a visit of John Kerry in Japan, historical visit. Nobody, you know, no Secretary of State visited the site of Hiroshima. Remember the story? We didn't know. Nobody knew then. Well, I wasn't alive, thank God. I was little. I wasn't born even. But nobody knew the consequence of atomic bomb. And Japan lives to know what it is, and to live after. And with the Fukushima explosion that happened too, and all the mess that was created, we are in pain, and we have to respect that. And sometimes when a country is in pain, they need a big arc from the universe and from people from all over. And I'm not sure that we are doing it, because they are really proud people. And as you remember, they didn't want to take any help from anybody. And I have an affection for Japan because I know, first of all, the food is excellent, right? But except that, I know one of the best doctors in the world, Dr. Fukushima, that operated on me in North Carolina. I can say for certain what a gentleman. And I remember when the situation in Fukushima erupted, I left him a message that said, whatever we have here, you can have. We don't want, you know, we want to give them whatever we can to help. And the only country that accepted the gift or help from was from Israel. Because we open our heart and we say, you can have it, because we want you to live. We want you to be there. And now there was a visit, historical visit, that could have, you know, gone differently, but it didn't. So let's see, let's hear what they have about the John Kerry visit there.
Commemoration at Hiroshima's Peace Memorial Park. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, along with six other foreign ministers, took part in a wreath-laying ceremony meant to convey peace and hope for the future. With his historic visit to the memorial, Kerry becomes the most senior U.S. administration official to pay his respects. The U.S. has never apologized for dropping atomic bombs on Japan, and Kerry wouldn't be either.
This trip is not about the past, it's about the present and the future, particularly, and the strength of the relationship that we have built, the friendship that we share, the strength of our alliance, and a strong reminder of the imperative we all have to work for peace, for peoples everywhere.
Depending on how Kerry's visit is received, government officials say President Barack Obama is also considering stopping at the site when he heads to Japan in May for G7 meetings. It would be unprecedented. No serving U.S. president has ever visited the memorial. Hiroshima residents welcomed Kerry's visit, with many saying they recognize the significance.
As a Hiroshima resident, I'm proud that so many people, from people my age to the elderly, came to see what's going on. I'm also happy so many people are thinking about peace.
Japan and the U.S. are both seeking stronger ties over concerns about China's increasing assertiveness in territorial disputes in Asia.
All right. It was a visit very, very well received. However, no apology. No, I'm sorry. No. Technically, you know, it really doesn't matter, right? But it matters to people. People felt that there was a shortcoming. Now, we don't know that if the president going to visit in May, going to say anything or visit the site. It's the first president, so it's going to be huge anyway. But you know, saying I'm sorry goes a long way, doesn't take much, and we need grace before God. And sometimes when we want grace, we need to amend our past action. We cannot think ever to come ahead in life and ask for more of forgiveness without cleaning our act. There is no way. It doesn't work this way. This is not the road of redemption of anybody. And we're all in a mess. You know, it's not like life is perfect, peachy anywhere in the world. It's all going crazy because the balance between faith and trust and God is really, really happening. And we really need to come through and ask God for forgiveness. And what is forgiveness? He said, yes, we did that. We didn't mean to do that harm. We didn't mean to kill. Of course, I know that that was a normal. It's a war. Everything was up and about. It wasn't funny. And, you know, it's not like apologize for the action. It's saying I'm sorry it happened. We could have gone different way. You know, they should have gone different way too. You know, Pearl Harbor wasn't funny either. They shouldn't have done that. So maybe if we prepare reciprocation of some sort, we start amending. And you know, when North Korea is in play and it's the wild card that nobody is talking to, nobody is doing anything, and he's a young man with a lot of potential if you take him the good way, you know, right now I heard that there is a tour guide that's going to North Korea and they're opening the gate to Israelis. And I'm saying, oh my God, how come? They want normalization. So let's consider that life is too short for us to decide that bully will stay bully and a stupid will stay stupid and war is war. Peace is a word that can be a way of being, too. So with Ganga Mora, we started, and let's go to the next music that we have. We're almost running out of time. Yeah, I know that.
Should David Cameron take notice of the United States warning not to leave the European Union?
Should David Cameron take notice? A shot has been fired across his bow by the United States saying America is against any decision on that. The Irish Prime Minister said exactly the same. It would be a disaster if we left the European Union. Germany pitched in today saying you can't blackmail other states. It won't provide a political future. It's neither wise nor useful to reopen the box. This is a subject, obviously, that the Prime Minister is about to make a speech on, we think, in a couple of weeks' time. So it's very much on the agenda. Should the government take notice of what the Americans are saying? Ed Davey.
Yes. When our closest ally, the United States, and when our very close allies like the Irish and the Germans, but not just that, British business people, are saying that we must be incredibly careful. David Cameron must be very careful. We don't want to sleepwalk out of the European Union. They're saying it for very good reasons. First of all, actually, they're saying it because they know that it's in Britain's economic interest to be in the European Union. Jobs are what's critical. We need jobs, and trade with the European Union is critical for many, many jobs.
But are you saying Cameron's got it wrong? I'm sorry, that's
well,
the key.
We haven't
heard
his speech yet. But what I do think is, if you listen to what the Americans are saying,
out referendum.
Well, what the Americans are saying is that we have got greater influence if we're in the European Union. I think that's what Beijing probably thinks. I think that New Delhi, I think the whole world thinks that the UK has more influence, is stronger and is more secure if it's in the European Union. Let me give you one other example about why I think Britain should stay in the European Union. The cooperation that we're having now with our European colleagues on tackling crime is not talked about, but it's really significant. This country is threatened by international crime, mafia, organised crime, human trafficking, drugs.
You have to be in the EU to control crime.
No, well, I tell you what, no, it really helps us. Okay. Seriously, the European...
No, I'm not suggesting you're not being serious. I'm saying, is it relevant?
It's very relevant.
Right.
Until we had the European arrest warrant, there were British criminals, rapists, murderers, who were going to Spain to Costa del Crime and escaping the law. Because the European Union brought in the European arrest warrant, those wicked people are now serving time behind bars under Her Majesty's pleasure.
Well, it's
that's the sort of thing we can get by staying in the European Union.
That's not the point that the Americans or the Germans or the Irish were making.
Well,
I want to stick with that.
Can I disagree with Ed?
Yes, we only have a couple of minutes left, I'm afraid. So if you can disagree...
Can I disagree with Ed very briefly?
Yes, that'd be great.
I mean, I think Ed's portraying the US message as a sign of our weakness, really. It's not. I think it's a sign of our strength. I mean, we are the fifth largest economy in the world. We are the only country in the European Union which has a really functioning military. You know, when America wants to go to war, when America wants to go into some military adventure, whether you agree with that or not, it doesn't pick up the phone to Brussels, it picks up the phone to London. It wants us in the European Union because we are strong. And I think there's too much defeatism about this issue. We can, if we negotiate properly, we can negotiate some of those powers back. I don't want to go into the drug laundering or the crime, but there are powers that we need to take back. We do not want to be run by Europe. The Working Time Directive...
We'll do it on subsequent programmes. All right, let's not be defeatist about what the government is intending to do by way of renegotiation.
Well, let's not see the US message as defeatist. It's about our strength.
John Bird, briefly, if you would, because we really have...
Briefly, I think the problem with Europe is that nobody has really educated us correctly as to what is actually happening. What are our advantages? What are our disadvantages? There are many, many disadvantages. The greatest disadvantage for me is when I hear some of these cockamamie plans that come out of Strasbourg and the other places, where you actually think there is another government telling us what to do, which we wouldn't do that way, we would do it totally different. I think there is too little understanding of the pluses and minuses. So I would like a referendum, I have to say. I'd like a referendum, but based on the fact that it was done because we had the cognitive ability to understand what were the pluses and minuses, should we stay in or should we go out?
OK. And... John Prescott, faced with these warnings from America, from Germany, from Ireland, what's your reaction?
Well, just to say, I've led a campaign against going into the common market. We had a referendum and we lost. Just remind people they don't come easily that way. Secondly, just bear in mind these are global problems and we need global solutions. Environment and Kyoto is an example of that. Ed, you have to negotiate with these. Europe's an important card in those negotiations. But don't lose sight of America. America looks to its own interests, not ours. They like our acceptable face in Europe. But in fact, what they do, if you look at the climate change, they refused internationally and still do to join up to a global solution because that is in their interest.
You're saying ignore the advice coming from
America.
Well,
hear it, listen to it, but don't forget that the Americans are looking after their interests, not our interests.
Okay.
And sometimes we're the acceptable face.
Nadine, very briefly, people.
We send £53 million a day from the UK into Europe. One of those days, £53 million would save Lewisham Hospital. I think we should be out of the Europe. I would like not to send that money to Europe every day. And I think the Americans should look after America's business interests and we'll look after our own. Thank you very much.
Good.
All right. That was a cute one. The idea of Britain leaving the European Union, they complain of the economy, they complain on security, and they complain on what else? Other issues that David Cameron was raising, and actually they say that they reform it, and there is some kind of agreement that he was predicting that will happen. But right now with the situation on the Panama list that David Cameron, I don't think that he can bring it through, especially, you know, the stature of a leader sometimes get diminished with stories that even that they are not important and they're not true and it just, you know, they put mud in them. It will take some time to clear them up. So until the vote will come, I hope that England per se will decide what she wants to do, and whatever it is, we love the Queen, we love England. England is such a power in the world that we all honor by its presence wherever it is, and of course it's impossible to encompass it in the European, you know, Union. It's not perceivable, but maybe the president of the, you know, special stage or status we need to give England, that's for sure, okay? There is something that we need to bring to the table that, you know, let's talk to the European Union. They're not done yet with the Brits. They're not done yet. Anyway. I think that we are running out of time now, and I want to wish you a great, great continuous week and weekend ahead. And I hope that you come back to the table with understanding that everything is evolving faster because the energy, everybody is accumulating a lot of energy to do stuff. The situation on the global market is a little scary because we are not predicted to grow like we should grow as a community. Globalization is not happening. And let me repeat what I've said over and over again since 2002. Until we don't create the tool to globalize markets, we cannot accept the markets to behave accordingly. And it's not about Google that give you the engine. It's not about any kind of, you know, ketchup that you can find on your app, you know, option in your computer or in your laptop or in your telephone. We have to organize. The world needs to come to term with the fact that we are not alone and we are connected. Now, we are connected. The only thing is we need to put the signature on top. It means that we need to decide that we are working accordingly. All the Western power, the peaceful, loving people of the world can come together. You can engage. We can create a session about what the World Trade Organization needs to look like. And I'm telling you, The ideas are in place. The tools are in. We just need to make a decision to prepare it. It's not a, you know, it's not out of the world. We launch shuttle to space. We can do it. So there we go. If you guys want to talk about it, I'm here. You can email me. You can write to BBS Radio and to The Impossible Truth. You can connect with me, Orly Benny Davis, online. You can find me. I have some ideas about how globalized economy needs to look like, and it's not yet there. So let's go to the next level. We need to step up to the plate of this world, because the world is running ragged, okay? Security needs to be in place. And of course, that's the first thing that the world needs to have, the security base of everybody, technology-wise and actually security on place. And if we connect, we can safeguard and make it happen. And by all means, I want to bless you all. I love you. God bless you. May this be the start of a new age. God bless you. Bye-bye. Ciao, ciao.